September 5th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Alan Lichtman says Kamala Harris is going to win the presidency. Yes, you are probably familiar with one of the two proper names mentioned in the preceding sentence. Alan Lichtman, the one you're not familiar with, he's a professor, a history professor, who possesses a kind of anti-charisma, but definitely a shtick that the New York Times finds charming. Or at least wants to put forward as charming, so they cut together a sumptuous video of the 77-year-old jogging around the track, interspersed with his opinion on the presidential race. It's a race, get it? They're both a kind of race.
To make his presidential predictions, Allen's model ignores the polls and the pundits.
It hinges on 13 keys that I developed in 1981 with my geophysicist friend, Vladimir Kailas Borok. It's based on 120 years of presidential election outcomes before then.
Told you, he's a nerd.
But there are correct nerds, there are incorrect nerds, and in Lichtman's case, a correct, for mostly accidental, reasons nerd. Like other prognosticators, let's say Nate Silver or an advisor to a financial firm who wants guidance on who's going to win the election, they look at economic factors, economic growth, fair enough. He takes into account some subjective factors like candidate charisma, seems reasonable. It stands to reason, in fact, in a year when the economy's pretty good, when there are no scandals in the incumbent party, when the challenger isn't some political demigod, that the incumbent would win. In years where the opposite's true, the economy's bad, the incumbent party is mired in scandal, the incumbent party will lose. Well, Lichtman has made a cottage industry, or at least gotten hundreds of media interviews over the faux scientific rigor of his 13 keys. And like I say, he does have his own brand of magnetism. He's 77 years old. He jogs. Let's just say he jogs. He has a bull haircut. You got to make a video out of this guy. He's also an inveterate self-promoter, but not just a self-promoter. As I said, the New York Times made this big video of him, and that wasn't the only place I saw it. 6 to 10 different sites, it's hard to count, but they were all telling me Alan Lichtman is in with his key to the election. And he is saying it's going to be Kamala. And you know what? He'll probably be right, but just slightly probably. Little more probable than improbable, and I base this not on his keys, but on real prognosticators like Nate Silver and the prediction markets. Alan Lichtman, however, has been right every single time for 5 of the last 6 elections. That's not really that impressive, but anyway, let's pretend it is. He did get Trump right in 2016, though he got the Gore versus Bush result wrong. But the important thing is, if he is right and still kicking and jogging, he will be very available for interviews in 2028. And if not, we'll all stop and ponder that, wait, Alan Lichtman promised us that Trump wouldn't be president. Well, maybe we won't ponder that. Maybe we'll have other issues to concern ourselves with. On the show today, Tim Pool, dupe, stooge, or rakish cap wearer. But first, Adam Kirsch was with us yesterday, digging into the root and meaning of settler colonialism. He's back today to pick up where he left off. He is, after all, the author of the new book on settler colonialism, Ideology, Violence, and Justice. If you missed yesterday's show, consider going back and listening to part one as an orientation. It will set the scene. If not, if so, in either case, Adam Kirsch part two is up next. Adam Kirsch is the author of On Settler Colonialism, Ideology, Violence, and Justice. And I started this part of the interview by acknowledging that most examples of decolonization are seen as just results. Few people want Africa to be controlled by 6 European countries today. So, if colonization is unpopular, and decolonization is good, as it's seen, and Israel is unpopular, as it is, maybe the reason why the phrase colonizer or settler colonialism attaches itself to Israel is that the people doing the attaching would like to think that the label will bring about a good or just outcome. Kirsch takes it from there.
Right. And I think that it gets to this strange sort of hybrid nature of how Israel was created. When you think of colonization, what you think of in most cases is there's a European country that has an empire. They send soldiers to another place, conquer it, and take it over, and they oppress the natives and profit from their labor and extract resources. And that was the story of sort of British colonization in India and French colonization in North Africa, or the Dutch in the East Indies. That was sort of classic European imperialism and colonialism. Then there's settler colonialism, which is sort of an older process and means people actually go to the land and live there and take it over, like in America and in Canada. But as I was getting at a little bit earlier, Israel is not in that situation because it was not conquered by a foreign country that then settled people there. It was settled by Jews who were themselves sort of refugees from oppression in Europe, and they were acting usually in defiance of empires that already ruled that territory. So before World War I, it was the Turkish Empire, and after World War I, it was the British Empire. And the British, for a brief period, allowed open Jewish immigration, but then stopped because they saw that the Arabs opposed it. So it was never a situation where a powerful country was coming to conquer and put people there and get rid of the natives. It was a situation where a people that was oppressed in Europe and, in fact, almost destroyed in Europe in the Holocaust managed to sort of send a small remnant of people to this land, which they considered their historic homeland, which was their sort of ancient center of belief. So the Jewish population of Israel in 1948, when the country was founded, was about 500,000. Yeah. So it was a very small number of people. So the remedies of decolonization don't apply in that case because, first of all, there's no mother country for those people to go back to. You can't go back to anywhere the
this
way they—
This the is French the idea of the metropole, yes.
Right. There's no metropolitan country. There's no mother country for them to go back to. And also, there's a sense that Israel is the only Jewish country in the world. It's the only place in the world where Jewish language and Jewish beliefs and Jewish culture are the sort of official or dominant ones. And so if it's destroyed, that would be the end of this civilization, which is not the case in other colonies as well.
Yeah. Now, of course, the Palestinians would say not our problem, but—
Yes.
Yeah. But you took it in a different direction, which is the reason why this hasn't been discredited because all of the examples seem to have worked out. And your point was it's not a good example. It doesn't map onto all the previous examples.
Right.
I was thinking of there are also, we don't like to admit it or get into it, but the decolonization of Rhodesia, Zimbabwe seems to have been a disaster. And so even if you take the establishment of that colony as Rhodesia as some awful, evil act, just in terms of, I think, every applicable measure, things seem to have gone much worse afterwards. But that does not really get a lot of attention in the West.
Well, it's definitely true that there was this decolonization movement that sort of swept the world in the 1950s and 60s. Almost all of the European colonies in Asia and Africa gained independence, and many of them were badly off afterwards and faced a lot of political and economic problems. Others were not, and others were able to establish, you know, more successful societies. I think it's true that everyone would agree that European imperialism was evil. No one calls for it to be returned or sustained, and that there was sort of an obvious moral logic to the idea that you shouldn't go to another person's country, take it over, and, you know, take their resources and to take their labor to profit from it. Although that was, you know, considered completely normal and meritorious in Europe for a long time, for hundreds of years. In the 20th century, really after World War II, that idea changed. And a large part of the reason why it changed was because Britain and France and the United States fought a war against Germany and Japan for doing exactly that, for invading other people's countries and sort of plundering them. And so then it became hard to sustain the idea, well, it's wrong for Germany to invade Poland, it's wrong for Japan to invade the Philippines, but it's right for France to invade Algeria, right? That became a big problem. And over the following decades, those countries were decolonized. And the real question, I think, in Israel and Palestine is not about whether there should be some Palestinian sovereignty. I think that most people would say that there should be some Palestinian sovereignty. There should be a Palestinian state. The question is, should there also be a Jewish state? And that's what the ideology of settler colonialism would say no. They would say there's no right or historical reason for there to be a Jewish state there. And just as, in a way, America doesn't deserve to exist and shouldn't exist, so Israel doesn't deserve to exist and shouldn't exist. So I think what a lot of people don't understand about, for example, campus protests or the language of the campus protests is that people who are calling for from the river to the sea are not calling for peace. That's not a slogan for peace. It's a slogan for one side of this conflict to defeat the other. So if you were to say, I think that Israel should expel all of the Palestinians, or I think that Palestinians should expel all the Jews, those are not calls for peace, but for, you know, destruction, for one side of a war to defeat the other side. And that's what's really been notably different about the response to this latest wave of conflict since October 7th. I think in previous waves, you didn't see large numbers of people, certainly not on college campuses, saying, from the river to the sea, let's destroy the state of Israel. There were often people saying that Israeli actions were inhumane or war crimes, or that many Palestinians were being killed. And that's certainly also the case in the current war, that many Palestinians are being killed. But what I'm trying to get at in this book and talking about settler colonialism is this basic ideology, this frame of way of looking at the conflict, which says there's no way that a Jewish state can be valid because it's a settler colonial state.
What does the anti-settler colonialist ideology say about countries that are very close, or countries whose existence are parallel in some ways, Israel? I'm thinking of Pakistan, which has many similarities with Israel. It was oppressed ethnic minority. There was mass movements of people after the establishment of Pakistan and East Pakistan, which eventually became Bangladesh. It's an ethno-state. All the things that get Israel labeled a settler colonialist state, you can apply that to Pakistan and India. Do they?
They don't. And the reason is that in those countries, the colonial power was Britain, and Britain left. So what's been true about the decolonization movement, you know, since the 40s and 50s, is that in the West, Western intellectuals...
But sorry to interrupt. The colonial power was whatever, the United Nations in the 1940s, but aid is still given. The UK still had some economic ties to India and Pakistan. But what I'm saying is the West left. Israel became its own country, just like Pakistan did. The right. Colonizers left.
And that's the sort of key issue, because from this point of view, the Jews were the colonizers and they didn't leave. And that's the sort of goal of this settler colonial idea, is that the Jews should either leave or at the very least not have their own country. I think most people who...
But I think one of the reasons that so many still emphasize white settler colonialism is you could also make the claim that the Europeans are there. The Jews are nothing but some subset of Europeans that we don't give a damn about their suffering. Or maybe some people would say we do, but it's not our problem. But right. The Europeans haven't left, you could argue, if you're against settler colonialism.
Exactly. No, absolutely. That's right. And what that is, that's true. But what it misses is some things that I think most people who have protesters on this issue or no slogans about this issue don't know, that in fact Israel's population is not majority European. It's about half of European origin and half of Middle Eastern origin, because after the state was founded in 1948, most of the Arab nationalist regimes around the region persecuted the Jews that had lived in those countries for a long time, and they all left. So in Israel today, there are Jews who are descended from Morocco and from Yemen and from Iraq and from Iran and all kinds of places in the Middle East. And there are also, of course, Jews from Ethiopia and other parts of the world. So I think that in the West, we think of Jews as white because most of the Jews in America, at least historically, are descended from Eastern Europeans and are white. But that's not true of Jews as a whole, and it's not true of Israel as a whole. This is another way in which Israel is sort of hard to make sense of, because Judaism is not an ethnic identity, it's a religion, and it encompasses people of many different ethnicities.
Yeah. So help me navigate this one, Adam. You're a man of letters, and you prize intellectual exchange, and I do too. I'm almost a First Amendment absolutist. I do not think these ideas shouldn't be shared, explored, promulgated, taught. I kind of wish the teaching would be a little more flexible and liberal, one of these feel free to disagree type situations. So then navigate that virtue of ideas need to be explored in the academy with the metastasizing of some of the worst versions of these ideas and the inability of much of American left-wing or academic life to properly contextualize them. What can be done? Arguing about them earlier, taking them seriously earlier? What?
I do think that I also would agree with you that what needs to be done is to discuss and argue about these ideas, not to ban them or for a state legislature to say you can't teach this or you can't teach that. I think that is counterproductive, and also it's contrary to the idea of free expression. The classic sort of liberal idea, liberal in the sense of you know, John Stuart Mill on liberty, is that there's a marketplace of ideas and people should be able to present different ideas and argue about them. And that's one thing that I want to do in this book. I mean, one reason why I wrote the book is that I think that there are a lot of books written about settler colonialism, hundreds about settler colonialism, but there have been few, if any, that write about it critically and point out the flaws in this idea. And that's what I wanted to do with this book. It's a short sort of introductory book saying there's another way to look at all of these things, and there are problems with this idea of settler colonialism. I would hope that you know, criticisms and arguments against should also be part of this education and can also find a home on universities. And really where you would have to draw the line is between teaching and discussion, which is what a university is all about, and sort of violent or threatening protest, which is about shutting down discussion and telling people that they can't enter or that they're not allowed or they're not allowed to be heard, their views are not legitimate. So I don't envy college administrators. I think they're in a very tough situation. But in this book, I'm not really writing about what should be done about colleges. I'm writing about the ideas themselves.
So there are some aspects intellectually of this question that are still anathemized within almost all of the United States. When pro-Hamas protesters waving the Hamas flag drew graffiti on Union Station in Washington, D.C., it wasn't even a question. Everyone of every political stripe, except maybe the Hamas sympathizers, came out against that. But the settler colonial discourse isn't in that Hamas camp, even though if you know, think about it for more than a second, there's a huge overlap. Do you think one of the reasons? So my point is that there are still ideas that have not gained any sort of purchase, but settler colonialism is not one of those. It does have widespread purchase. Is the reason, one of the reasons, that in order to attain the political outcome that maybe a lot of people would like, which is to either stop funding Israel or stop the bombing in Gaza or to bring about, get the settlers out of the West Bank, it's useful to have a very extreme ideology for essentially Overton window purposes. And then in a negotiation, a future imagined negotiation, someone could say, look, you know, the Jews have to get out of East Jerusalem because look at all these people on my left and all these people who are much more radical than I am. They will never accept anything less than that. So is that a dynamic that's going on?
I don't think most people are thinking about it in that tactical way, certainly not among American protesters. I don't think they think of it in those tactical terms. And the truth is that the situation of the question of what to actually do to solve the conflict has been so stalemated for such a long time that I don't know whether a solution is even in most people's ideas. And that's, in fact, one reason why this more extreme view has an appeal, is that people say, you know, we haven't been able to negotiate an end to the conflict. Maybe what we need is a victory of one side versus the other. I think a lot of people are starting to feel that way. But I don't think it's that exactly. But what I do think is that this is something, again, where the Israel situation has precedence, like in what happened in Algeria in the 1950s and 60s, that the Western left sees colonialism as the ultimate evil, or in this case, settler colonialism as the ultimate evil, and therefore anyone fighting it is good. And if Hamas is fighting settler colonialism, then Hamas is good. And so you did see after October 7th, a lot of people who presumably are not Islamic fundamentalists say that they were pro-Hamas or have images of gliders, right? Because gliders were used by some of the fighters who attacked civilians on October 7th to sort of glamorize and glorify this act of what they saw as anti-colonial resistance. The same thing happened in the 1950s and 60s in Algeria, where the forces fighting against the French really committed a lot of atrocities against the French and also against other Algerians, just as Hamas does against other Palestinians who don't agree with them in order to gain political power. But all of that is sort of seen as justified because it is in the name of liberation. It's in the name of freedom from colonialism. So I do think that a lot of people who, if they really thought consistently and deeply about what they believe, would be sort of appalled by Hamas and horrified by it, end up on the same side as people who are for Hamas because they think that the enemy that really matters is settler colonialism.
As a general rule of thumb, is there a threshold at which we should start paying attention to what seem like far out, often jargon-laden ideas in the academy?
I think that, yes, and that threshold, I think, for me, was October 7th and the response to it. I mean, I was aware of the idea of settler colonialism for a number of years and had been reading about it in academic settings, but when people started using the term a lot in public, in demonstrations, after October 7th, I realized that this has now moved from one milieu where it seems, you know, very academic and very out there, and it's having real effects. I mean, another good example of that is critical race theory.
Yeah.
Critical race theory was a very academic idea and movement in the 1970s. It was all about things happening in law schools. And 40 years later, suddenly it became a buzzword in which a lot of conservatives were angry or upset about critical race theory, probably not using the term exactly in the same way that the people who started it were using it, but it had entered into public discourse. So a lot of things that start out very small or seemingly abstract and strange do end up having real-world effects, and I think that this is one of those examples.
Do you think if this idea never took hold or didn't gain much traction beyond a couple academics in Australia, the debate or the contours of the debate about what's going on in Israel and Gaza would be much different? I mean, I think that the Pope would still be upset. He probably doesn't know much about settler or buy into settler colonialism, but the Pope is always decrying it because it's innocent people dying, and we're driven by images, and there are so many horrible images of innocent people dying. So that is my question. But for settler colonialism, would things be much different?
I think they would be different in the way that they're framed and discussed, and some of the more extreme elements in Western countries would either not exist or would use a different kind of language about it. But of course, you're right. The reason why this is an issue and why people are angry and upset about it is because it's a conflict in which many people are dying. And that is, until that's solved, people will be angry about it and will demand a solution. I think that the idea that I'm trying to get at is that settler colonialism is not a helpful way to view the conflict if what you want is a solution. In fact, it's the opposite. It tends to make the conflict more absolute and more zero-sum, so that there can't be a negotiated solution. There can only be a winner and a loser, and that's much more dangerous and in the long run worse for both Jews and Arabs in the region.
Adam Kirsch is an author of several books of poetry and criticism. His new book is On Settler Colonialism, Ideology, Violence, and Justice. Thank you so much, Adam.
Thank you.
And now the spiel. Tenet Media, which distributes some heterodox podcasts and posts some out-of-the-box thinking on social media, was indicted by the federal government. In the case, the hetero was Vlad Putin. I'm sure he would revel in that description. And the podcasters who were part of the indicted network are guys like Benny Johnson, Dave Rubin, and Tim Pool. Pool, on his podcast today, seemed almost bored at having to answer the accusation by the DOJ that he was the beneficiary of a Russian influence scheme.
When I first learned of this story, literally, I'm skateboarding. And I get a DM from a journalist asking if I would talk about the Russian allegations or whatever. And I was like, what? I was like, what allegations? And then they sent me a tweet and I'm like, I ain't reading that. Like, I'm sorry this happened to you or whatever. And then he said something. I'm like, dude, I have literally no idea what you're talking about. And so then I get some calls after a conversation with a few people. I was like, all right, I'll put out a statement. And I thought it was a leaked indictment. I didn't realize the DOJ actually did a press conference on all this stuff. So then when I just corrected and changed it. And so let me read this for you, and then we'll give you the context as to what this means for us and for you. I will stress that this literally has nothing to do with Timcast Media in any way.
Well, in some ways, he was paid a lot of money to have his show distributed by Tenet, who were paid by the Russians. The rest of us, I have to say, the rest of us in the podcasting game, sometimes ask, what does it take to really get a lucrative podcast deal? I don't know, you got to have a NFL playing brother and be in the NFL and date Taylor Swift. Okay, all those things are out. Or maybe you could just star in Ozark and BoJack Horseman and Will and Grace. Very hard for one person to do. They got three guys to do it. But barring that, maybe the other path to stardom in this media is just be a heterodox thinker, an out-of-the-box thinker, possibly have a beanie. But now we find out even that doesn't really work. It's just the Taylor Swift way of getting ahead. The market wasn't paying Tim Pool. The Russians were. It does seem that Johnson and Pool and the others didn't know that they were benefiting from Russian promotion efforts. The fact that their contacts within the Tenet Media organization would sometimes slip and refer to them as Moose and Squirtle, just a quirk. No, but in all seriousness, there really isn't evidence that these individuals, these podcasters, these previously pretty well-known and pretty well-listened to podcasters, no evidence that their opinions were crafted because they were funded by Russian money. Their opinions were honestly come by, which is not to say honest or accurate or correct or fair. Here was Tim Pool after Ukraine invaded Russia.
Ukraine is the greatest threat to this nation and to the world. We should rescind all funding and financing, pull out all military support, and we should apologize to Russia. They know it.
And here was Tim Pool 9 months ago.
The U.S. should not be involved in Ukraine's affairs. Sorry, I just do not see it. And I know it's tough because I know I say this all the time, but I know people who are Ukrainian. And I'm going to tell them I don't think the U.S. should be involved. The U.S. people do not want to be involved. And it's about time we stopped. I'm sorry to say, but the Russians have won. The Ukraine war is effectively over.
Then a month ago, Ukraine marched into Russia, took some territory, flipped the map a little bit. Pretty shocking, of course. We should note, because I'm trying to be fair, that the Russians just successfully, in quotes, attacked a site in Politova, killing more than 50 Ukrainians. In other words, it is a war. It is not a decided war. It is not a concluded war. It is an act of brutal and costly war. There is no indication that Tim Pool ever has changed or corrected his assessment of the war being over. And there is now an indication that the Russians were literally paying him to amplify that message. Sure, they weren't paying him to have the opinions. He had the opinions, and then they paid him. Now, if I were Tim Pool, I'd definitely take off the beanie. I'd stop skateboarding. I don't know, maybe he's good at it. But I would do a little bit of soul searching. It would give me pause to say, wow, the Russians liked it so much that they ponied up hundreds of thousands of dollars. But I am not Tim Pool. I mean, if I were skateboarding when I found out that the federal government had issued an indictment with me, if not named, strongly implied, I'd have gotten off the skateboard. I'd have taken it seriously. I'd have gotten started on a full and thorough assessment. Pool, Johnson, Rubin, they haven't done that. You know what they've done? They've used the chance to attempt to burnish their credentials as independent, as enemies of the federal government. They, in fact, describe themselves as victims. That is the literal word they used in their statements, that they were victimized by this scheme. But they took the money. Fine, let's say they didn't know. They haven't given back the money. There is no indication that they are going to give back the money. I don't see how those enriched by our adversaries can be properly described as victims. They might be dupes, but they're enriched dupes. They might not be the perpetrators of the crimes, but that doesn't mean they're the victims of the misdeeds. I don't do much listening to Tim Pool or Benny Johnson, and I will not start now, but I am curious if any of their legions of devotees will stop listening themselves, or if what should be an embarrassing setback for them and a diminishment of their reach and influence, will it actually serve as a message multiplier to mark them as rebellious enemies of the U.S. Justice Department and the U.S. State Department? For too many Americans, whoever one's enemies are, especially if they're domestic institutions, those people get so much cred that a documented association with actual U.S. enemies can't possibly make a dent. And that's it for today's show. The Gist senior producer is Joel Patterson. Producer is Corey Wara. Michelle Pesca is in charge of logistics. Logogistics. See what I did there? She won't. She doesn't listen to the credits. The Gist is presented in collaboration with AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Thanks for listening.